Welcome to WISO Weekend, your weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. I'm pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. Coming up in today's program, we've got Senior Voices, Dayton Youth Radio, and a new story from our County Lines series with producer Renee Wild. Up first, unmanned aerial drone technology is changing the way we live and work, and it's not just Amazon and other corporate giants getting into the drone game. The multi-billion dollar industry is forecast to grow exponentially in coming years. In this week's installment of our Scratch Innovation series, you'll hear about some of the surprising ways drones are altering, even enhancing, the human experience. And as I found out, as more drones take to the skies, the unmanned systems are raising new questions for business, government, and law enforcement.
Ready?
It's a bright, blustery day in Springfield when a small black drone rises up off the ground to hover before me. Its design is simple. It's sleek, square, and almost frisbee flat. This unmanned aerial vehicle, or UAV, has multiple cameras with facial recognition capabilities.
This is called a Sky DIO, is what it's called, and it's it can lock onto our faces. It can distinguish the difference between you and me, and if I walk over to a certain area, I'll kind of demonstrate how this thing works.
David Gallagher is the chief of staff at the Ohio-Indiana Unmanned Aerial Systems Center and Test Complex in Springfield. Today, he's demonstrating some of the latest advances in drone technology. As Gallagher moves around the parking lot, this drone pivots and follows him, adjusting its position between surrounding objects.
It's got 20 sensors on it that kind of monitor where it's at, so it'll pick up the ground, it'll pick up light poles, it'll pick up the flagpole, pick up the side of the building.
Gallagher says the Sky DIO uses its onboard cameras and other sensors to navigate, so it can make quicker decisions than other models, which rely solely on GPS navigation. And he's operating the drone from his cell phone.
Really easy control. It's simple to do. Anyone can take it out of the box, download the app, and start flying immediately.
Drones like this are already available commercially and can cost several thousand dollars. They are backed by some pretty slick marketing campaigns that feature athletes and adventurers documenting their conquest with the aid of their companion drones. The UAS Test Complex in Springfield was created in 2013 when Ohio Governor John Kasich and then Indiana Governor Mike Pence agreed to a regional collaboration aimed at developing drone technologies. A smart decision, with the drone industry expected to grow to $17 billion over the next 6 years. Gallagher says more and more government agencies around the country are using drones for building and bridge inspections, road mapping, traffic analysis, even search and rescue missions. He says drones will take some jobs traditionally done by humans.
People are going to use it for package delivery, and paramedics want to be using it for defibrillators and bringing emergency objects to people in need. It's really advancing at a rapid rate.
Yet all this technology is expected to create more than 100,000 jobs across the country over the next decade. Jobs in drone research, manufacturing, and operations, and they'll require special training. Numbers show demand for this training is growing in the Miami Valley.
Andrew.
At Sinclair Community College, Dr. Andrew Shepard says he's seeing double-digit growth every year in Sinclair's UAS credit and certificate program.
This is a lot of excitement. The industry continues to grow. A lot of students have moved on into positions now. Several have started their own startup companies, and it's a great time to get into the business.
Drone technology is developing fast. Shepard says it's outpacing the federal and state regulations experts say are needed to allow the industry to move forward safely. The Federal Aviation Administration recently released regulations governing commercial drones, but more regulations are needed.
And so sometimes you're kind of doing informed guessing of where you think that'll be heading and how long it'll take to get there. And so far we've done pretty good.
And it's likely there's more guesswork ahead. As drone technology expands and more governments, businesses, and consumers take to the skies, so does the potential for accidents.
I was in the driveway talking with my fiance and my mom, and lo and behold, a drone dropped out of the sky.
Beaver Creek resident R.J. McKay experienced a close call with a drone in 2016.
All of a sudden, there was this big ruckus kind of in the top of a 40-foot pine tree, and we thought it was a couple squirrels fighting, realized it was a drone.
How close were you to it when it came down?
We were actually only about 30 feet. So when you look at the statistical odds of things dropping out of the sky and near misses, I would call 30 feet a near miss.
Thank you for calling the FAA Drone Support Center. If you are calling to report an unsafe or unauthorized drone operation, please hang up and contact your local law enforcement.
Dozens more domestic drone accidents have been recorded in the last few years. The FAA says they were caught off guard by the fast-paced technology and growing availability of drones, but in the last few years, they have more firmly established regulations and protocols. And as recently as January, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine said the state would offer police officers advanced courses on investigating complaints. They also issued guidelines for law enforcement's use of UAS to investigate crime scenes, traffic accidents, missing persons, SWAT operations, and active shooter incidents. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. In Ohio, the opioid epidemic claimed the lives of hundreds of people last year. Thousands more ended up behind bars, and a lot of them were women. The picture is similar nationwide, where a record number of women are ending up in jails and prisons after an addiction. Reporter Allison Herrera from PRI's Across Women's Lives series takes us to Montgomery County, where more and more of these women are crowding the jail, waiting for drug treatment or a second chance.
All of the women behind bars at the Montgomery County Jail will tell you the same thing. They didn't wake up one day and decide to be addicted to drugs.
I was taking pain medication for my foot, and that's where opiates escalated to. And then they become too expensive on the streets, so you start using heroin. It's cheaper. It's easier to get.
That's a woman we'll call Janet. The jail wouldn't let me use her real name ahead of her court hearing. Another woman here who we'll call Beth has been in and out of jail 67 times. This time, she's here for a probation violation and burglary while high on methamphetamines. She's now using Vivitrol, a pill taken once monthly to treat opioid addiction. Beth has been abusing heroin for 22 years.
It's a real struggle. And my kids missed me. Now I'm missing my grandkids. It's a cycle that don't stop.
Stories like this are common in the state of Ohio. It's at the epicenter of a tidal wave of opioid abuse that's ripped families and communities apart, causing a huge spike in crimes related to that addiction and a record number of overdoses. Over the past 2 years, more than 3,600 women ended up behind bars here because of an addiction-related crime. That's double what it was in 2014.
We've had to reorganize because of the female population.
Major Matt Haynes, who's worked at the Montgomery County Sheriff's Department for 13 years, has never seen anything like it.
We didn't have enough beds.
Why are you going? The women's room here looks like an uncomfortable hospital waiting area. Two flat-screen TVs flank each end of a large day room, airing talk shows and cooking demonstrations, while women in dark green uniforms that resemble hospital scrubs play cards, sleep, read, or just sit around.
Oh my God. Five.
Go like this. You got a four.
Haynes knows this place isn't the answer to their problems.
We want them to get help. We want them to get better. And ultimately, we don't want them back in jail and reoffending.
That focus on help instead of punishment flies square in the face of those recent get tough comments made by President Trump. But experts here are sure of it. These women need treatment. Dayton police know it. Montgomery County Sheriff's Department knows it. And there are a lot of initiatives and programs that can get them that help. But the one thing women need to help them really get clean, to help them get back on their feet and stop using, someone who's been there, someone who can help them find that job, get that house, and stay connected to other women who are in recovery, too. There's a program that can help them do that, and it's in an unlikely place, prison.
This was an old warden's house that's come down. This is where we're now clearing out the lot, and we're actually going to have a new nursery built.
It's a chilly Monday afternoon in Marysville, Ohio, and I'm riding around on a golf cart. I'm getting a tour from Clara Golding Kent. She's the public information officer for the Ohio Reformatory for Women. Built in 1916, this is the oldest prison in the state. Our golf cart crawls towards one of the low-slung, concrete buildings that houses the Tapestry Program. It's an inpatient treatment program for women in this prison. They commit to it for 18 months. It focuses not only on keeping them clean and sober, but changing their lives. Annette Dominguez, who leads this program, says the goal is to heal mind, body, and spirit.
It's not just about not using drugs anymore, but it's about changing how you think about the world, how you think about your place in it, how you think about yourself, most importantly, because most of the women come with serious self-esteem issues, in addition to their substance abuse issues, in addition to the sexual abuse, domestic violence, the myriad issues that, you know, that they have. And so they come here where you have all of these women who have really similar problems and challenges and experiences, and the community itself is the agent of change.
Nowhere is that change more evident than on the faces of women in Tapestry. Right now, they are practicing for an upcoming talent show. They sing, others are working on their dance routines, and hula hoops are even involved.
I live here in the house with the sisters.
That's Lisa Duncan, a graduate of Tapestry. In here, they refer to each other as sisters. Lisa is still in prison, serving her sentence, and she gets to come back and work at Tapestry.
We are just here basically to just guide them in the right direction. I'm a repeat offender, and that's why I think it's very important for me to be here, because the sisters will understand that if you don't stay connected, then there's definitely another number under your belt. If you don't stay connected, you're definitely not strong enough to stand on your own out there. It's too hard. So we have to understand that we need each other to survive.
Because on the outside, there's just not enough support. For so many women, this is the first program that's worked. Ashley Porter is in Tapestry, too, and she's still serving out her sentence. She struggled with addiction and couldn't find a program that helped her until she came here to prison.
I went through a detox program through Mary Haven, and I was only in it for a couple weeks, and then I just went back to using. But I think this program, it makes me want to be clean. It makes me want to be a better person. It taught me a new way of living, and it's possible to really go home and, you know, do the right thing.
Tapestry is a small part of the solution to addiction and female incarceration in the state of Ohio. It's not everything. People working in the community, the police, state and local health officials all recognize addiction is something you can't solve overnight. Another thing they agree on, you can't just arrest your way out of this problem. And that for a lot of these women, they just need a second chance.
One foot onto the ice, I hold my breath, and try to believe.
For the World, Allison Herrera, Marysville, Ohio.
Can I look at you with different eyes, like the girl that I was when I was 17? The fallen empires, the shattered glass, the wicked echoes of my past. I've seen it all before, that's why I'm asking.
That story was part of a collaboration between WYSO and PRI's Across Women's Lives series. To see photos of women featured in the story and to learn more, visit WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Health and strength seem like a given when we're young, and so for a teenager to have a near-death story is somewhat unusual, and that is what we have today from Dayton Youth Radio. Here's Project Coordinator Basim Blunt.
I met Scott Lytle last fall in our Dayton Youth Radio class, and he told me he was 19 years old, and I asked him why he's still in high school. And he shared this story about his lost year.
I'm Scott Lytle, a 19-year-old that goes to Ponens. I also like to draw. I want to tell you a story about the day my life almost changed last year. I woke up, got ready for school. I got to school and had a normal day until I got to the gym. Me and Quincy started playing pickleball using wooden rackets. Quincy accidentally hit me in my stomach. I felt okay for about 5 seconds, then I dropped to the ground in pain. I got up, went to the bathroom to put water on my face, still didn't work, so I laid on the ground. I was bleeding from the inside of my stomach from the blow. Turns out I had a cyst on my liver that was growing. A student came in the bathroom and then went to go get help. So they called my teacher at the time, Ms. Wilson. She called my mom, and my mom called the ambulance.
So then I basically came up to the school to find out what was going on. And the moment I saw you, I knew that you were in a desperate situation. I mean, you were starting to kind of lose your color a little bit. You kept complaining that you couldn't breathe, you couldn't breathe.
They came and put me on the stretcher and took me to the hospital.
You know, I kept talking with you and doing everything that I could to keep you alert because I didn't want you to go to sleep because I was afraid that if you would have went to sleep, that would have been it.
The doctor told me if I passed out anywhere else, I could have died.
We probably sat, me, myself, your dad, and your grandma, we all sat in the waiting room while you were in surgery. And, you know, the surgeon came out and he basically told us that they had to resuscitate you 3 times. It was a very scary time. You know, I mean, I know I stayed there with you for several days just so that I would have a sense of security about the whole situation until, you know, it kind of got to the point where it was like, you know what, I can't make anything happen by me being here. I might as well go home and get some rest.
My mom said they had me hooked up to so much equipment to keep me alive. I was in a coma for 3 days. One night in ICU, I had a dream that I saw my grandma, who passed away when I was 12. She told me to keep pushing on.
A cyst on the liver is something that can go so undetected. It's really scary. One of the things that you had experienced due to the cyst or your liver rupturing was that your intestines and your stomach had started to fill up with blood. I'm just thankful that in the midst of all of this, you only suffer from a minor tear. They were able to go in and fix it, and you've been fine ever since.
Let's just say your friend is in pain. You should call the ambulance, or you're in the hospital. You should know how to handle that. You should be calm. You should be able to help your friend get through the situation. I found out that life is precious, and you should never take life for granted at all. For Dayton Youth Radio at Punish Technology Center, this is Scott Lytle.
That was 911, written and produced by Scott Lytle, a senior at Ponens Career Technology Center. Special thanks to Joanne Biscup and Jeffrey Crowell at Ponens. To hear more stories from this series, you can visit our website at wyso.org or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basine Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. Mary Ellen Graham has lived in Dayton her entire life. She grew up on the East Side, attended the University of Dayton, and worked as a middle school teacher for 34 years, retiring in 2001. And she loves reading. Today on Senior Voices, Mary Ellen shares her story with Dayton Metro Library volunteer interviewer Nancy Messer.
Oh, I have lots of stories, I guess. And a lot of them are actually related to reading and enjoying reading because I mentioned before that my family was German and working hard was a very highly praised quality to have. And my mother made sure that we were always busy. And when I got old enough to read, and I loved reading, and I discovered that she couldn't find me if I took my library book and went under the glider on the front porch. And then she discovered my hiding place. And I remember the first time she saw me, I think I was maybe 6 or 7, and she said, "Don't you have any work to do?" And she was a very loving, nurturing kind of mom, but it's just that you had to keep busy, and every day you had to accomplish something. In fact, even to this day, I'm in a book club, and I ended up being a language arts teacher. I spent my life actually reading in one way or another. My mother grew up on a farm, both my parents did, and they both dropped out of school at 8th grade. They were needed to help on the farm. So even though they didn't have an education, either one of them really, but they were very supportive, and they always emphasized learning to all three of us. Read, read, read. I think that is so important, and to read both sides of an issue. read, 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 and use your library. If you don't have books at home, come to the library. It's all here and it's free. I would not have been able to read to the extent that I could because we didn't have any money. You didn't buy books. You know, books were something you either got in school or you got them at the library. And it's a wonderful opportunity. There's no place you can't go. There's nothing you can't learn. There's no experience you can't have. And books are probably one of the best ways of getting yourself to start there.
That was retired teacher and reading enthusiast Mary Ellen Graham speaking with Nancy Messer as part of the Senior Voices Project. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Javis Heberling. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible through the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation. Although the term urban sprawl was coined in the 1930s, by the 1970s it was a hot topic as increasingly more rural areas and farmland were divided up and paved over into strip malls and subdivisions. This spreading ring around our cities where urban sprawl is happening is officially known as the rural-urban fringe. And it's there that producer Renee Wild takes us to today on County Lines.
The urban fringe is a transition zone between town and country, where rural and urban uses meet, mix, and sometimes clash. In 1969, Mary and Robert Beck, along with their three young sons, moved their dairy operation to a 178-acre farm in Jamestown, Ohio. Back then, the area was a thriving farming community.
Well, hogs were prevalent in this area because there was a lot of corn grown in the area, and it was hogs and beef cattle.
And then Mary, now 88, and two of her sons, David and Tim, are gathered around her kitchen table in that original farmhouse. Her sons describe what it was like when they first moved here.
And then once we moved up here, what, for 6 months probably? Was it 6 months?
I'd say three.
Three?
Mm-hmm.
Dad went down and milked the cows at Spring Valley and came back up here until we transformed all the buildings from hog barns to cattle barns to move the dairy herd up here.
My husband got cancer in 91.
When Dad passed away, David and I then rented the farm from Mom and started grain farming and raised a few head of cattle.
Yeah.
David and Tim are now in their 50s, with families of their own, and urban sprawl is pushing in on the land that they have farmed for the past 5 decades. So the Beck brothers wanted to preserve their family farming heritage for their kids and their grandkids.
On the other side of the county, every day they're building up more and more, and there's less and less farm ground, and sooner or later, you have to be able to feed the people, and you're going to need the ground. So we just thought this was a good opportunity to join the block around us and just create a larger area that would be preserved agriculture.
The Beck brothers joined with some of their surrounding neighbors, and they put their property into a farmland preservation easement with the help of the Tecumseh Land Trust, a nonprofit group that works with local farmers to preserve Ohio's farmlands.
There's 6 or 7 farms joined up here that are all together.
There's a couple thousand acres all together now.
During the 4-year process to secure the easement, the Becks could see the urban sprawl growing closer to their farmland.
There's a farm about 2 to 3 miles from here that was split up into housing development. It was a very, very productive farm, and we hated to see that disappear.
When that former farm was divided into around 20 different plots, three pilots bought land to build homes with adjacent private grass airstrips. Jeff Stinson was one of the first.
We were looking for a place out in the country, and this whole farm used to be one big farm, 500 acres, and they started dividing it up and thought, well, I can make a nice strip there, so I bought that and built the strip.
Jeff and fellow neighbor pilot Dewey Davenport are sitting in lawn chairs outside a large pole barn filled with vintage biplanes on Dewey's property. Dewey explains why these plots of former farmland were perfect for the pilots.
If you notice, pretty much every airplane in here is an antique, and they're made for grass runways and short takeoff and landing type flying. So it's about a quarter mile long. It's a perfect length.
As the 20 or so lots from the original sale of the farm continue to be re-subdivided and sold, more houses and barns are cropping up on the road.
We've been in our place for 8 years, going on 9 years now. We've seen it to where
you could look out the window and see one neighbor down the road, but now I'm seeing six and seven houses. So,
the irony isn't lost on them that the same continued sale of farmland that allowed them to build their country airstrips may also be the reason they get pushed out of the area eventually. As the rural-urban fringe continues to push outward, it's gobbling up farmland at an amazing speed. Since 1950, over 7 million acres of Ohio farmland have been lost. Only two-thirds remain. Through their preservation easement, David and Tim Beck know that their farm will be one of those that remain for the next generation.
We're not in it for the profit. We're in it because we like the lifestyle. We like to see plants come up in the spring. We like to see plants be productive. You know, we want to see the ground survive. We want to see it remain productive.
You know, it's in our best interest to take care of everything and preserve the resources.
For County Lines on WYSO, Renee Weil, Jamestown, Ohio.
Take to the highway, won't you lend me your name? Your way and my way, they seem to be one and the same. Mama don't understand.
County Lines is made possible by a generous grant from Ohio Humanities. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Thanks for joining us. The Asian American Council of Dayton and participating organizations hope that expanded health and fitness services will attract more people, including young audiences, to their annual health expo. With that goal in mind, they have added fitness elements, including group and individual instruction classes in a variety of disciplines to the event. Dr. Ron Katsuyama chairs the AAC and serves as event coordinator for this year's health fair. In this interview, he talks about the council's mission, including its formation after 9/11, and provides more details about the health fair.
The Asian American Council goes back to 2002 in the aftermath of 9/11, when we heard in the various ethnic communities various bias-related incidents. And so we decided to convene leaders of various ethnic organizations. There were seven in all. And we formed the Asian American Council from there. And its mission was to provide education and also to celebrate various cultural traditions, provide training for youth to become leaders, and just encourage active participation in civic activities.
That's quite an interesting start for the organization. And can you quantify or summarize the impact that you've had in the now 16 years?
Well, one of the major events was a town hall forum to try to educate the general public about the various ethnic groups. For example, there was a lot of confusion about the nature of the Sikh society, and there were a lot of people who confused Sikhs with Muslims. They're very different groups. And so we had meetings around town like that. We also had a solidarity resolution, which was introduced to various cities and townships. I believe there were nine in all, including Montgomery County and various cities throughout the area.
And before we talk about the health fair coming up, tell me a little bit about the makeup of the council.
Sure. We have sitting at the table leaders from each of the major ethnic organizations, Asian ethnic organizations in the greater Dayton area. And we have had a variety of activities, including health screenings and workshop presentations. This one is our largest event. It's the first ever health fair and fitness expo. It started in a really, to me, kind of surprising way. The health fair started with an idea from an Asian physician by the name of John C. Koduri and her son, Shravan Kalahasti. They approached me and said there's a huge disparity in the bone marrow registry for Asians compared to the general public. If somebody is in need with a life-saving bone marrow transplant, there's about a 92% chance of finding a match in overall. But among those in the Asian communities, it could be as low as 2 to 3% for Southeast Asian immigrant groups. So this got me thinking, why don't we do something about it and support a bone marrow drive? And from that, we got the idea, well, let's have a health fair. But health fairs don't attract huge groups, especially young people. So we added a fitness expo with a lot of attractive activities that could attract people of all ages, from children all the way to elderly. We have, for example, not just the traditional screenings, both physical and behavioral, but we have dozens of presentations by professionals on a variety of topics, everything from acupuncture, aging in America, bullying, cancer detection, dental care. I could go down the alphabet to stress management, traditional Chinese medicine, violence prevention, wellness strategies. It's just staggering how many experts just step forward and said they want to be a part of this.
To recap, we're speaking with Ron Katsuyama, who is the chair of the Asian American Council, and you are having a health fair and now a fitness expo on April 14th at Christ Church United Methodist on Schroyer Road in Kettering, and that's going to run 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and you've got a lot of services. This obviously has grown over the years, especially with the addition of this fitness expo.
Yes, this is a first time ever event where we have so many activities going on at once. When somebody arrives, they'll be finding just a lot of things to do. In fact, we have about five tracks with different activities, including the screenings, major talks on various topics. We have two sets of fitness activities going on simultaneously, individual classes, and we have ethnic cooking demonstrations. And our fitness expo is designed to appeal to all ages. We'll have children's games. We'll have lessons in guided meditation or yoga, individually or in groups. So there's just a lot of activities going on. So if you come early and plan the day, I think there'll be a lot of interesting and enjoyable activities for everyone, from children to elderly adults.
And great. If people want more information on this, they can visit aacdayton.org. You've also got a Facebook page where you list several events.
Yes. Our complete schedule of activities is listed on both. Or people from the general public can call the Latino Asian Native American Center at Wright State University. Their number is 937-775-2798, 775-2798.
I've been speaking with Dr. Ron Katsuyama. He's the chair of the Asian American Council and event coordinator of the Health Fair and Fitness Expo. Again, that's taking place April 14th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Christ Church United Methodist. That is directly across from Fairmont High School on Schroyer Road. Ron, thanks so much for your time and good luck with this event.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your helping us get the word out.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. And coming up next on WISO, it's The Book Nook with Vic McCunis.